All right, everyone. Welcome back to Back on the Bus podcast with Swain Tuft and Ryan Anderson. This week we had a great chat with Andrew Pinfold, an old friend, a guy we race with on some metrics, a guy that I've been, for me, he's been around BC cycling for ages. He has a very different approach than a lot of us, and we'll get into that exact approach in this podcast. But he's just he's a fascinating character, really funny guy, and like I said, he's a guy who really binds a team together. You know, gets people laughing, keeps them talking, and I always feel like with a sport filled with a lot of type A introvert type people, you always need a character like Pinner. And I feel fortunate to have raced with him in my years with Symmetrics, and then also racing against him after that on UHC and Floyd's. So he had some great stories about Floyd's team as well. So yeah, sit back, have a good listen, and hope you enjoy this one. All right, we got Andrew Pinfold, aka Pinner, aka Panier, aka the Pan Man. He's on the Back of the Bus podcast. We're pretty excited to have him here. Pinner, what's going on, bud? What have you been up to?
Oh, a lot of cross-country skiing, actually. Probably you know that. I've got my family's just gone insane for cross-country skiing. I live in North Vancouver, Cyprus, just up the road, like 20-minute drive from our house. Got a lot of snow. Put the kids in Hollyburton, Nordic. Yeah, cross-country skiing. Who would have thought? I remember back in the day, you and I, Dwayner, and we would just talk about how lame cross-country skiing was, or at least I would. Because when we were touring, and I thought that was the way to go, and now I'm eating my words.
You're looking good sticks. Up there. Every time I've been up and seen you, you got a very nice style. I can tell you've been working hard. So, and who would have thought you would have taken on such a hard sport? A guy like you, you know, because my recollection was you were kind of the least amount of work possible kind of scenario. And now you're taking most difficult endurance sports I can actually ever think of.
Yeah, there's not as much drafting in cross-country skiing as there is in biking. And it's funny because you introduced me with those two nicknames, Panier, and I think you came up with Panier. And it never struck me as to why I had that nickname until I think it was Andrew Randall at some point just said, yeah, your nickname's Panier because you're always – behind somebody. You're never in the wind, you're never in front, right? So yeah, you probably through your podcast you're going to interview a whole bunch of people that are like, you know, hardcore out in front doing all these crazy endeavors. That wasn't me when I was racing. I really did have the sprinter's mentality of figuring out ways to win or get results in bike races doing the least amount possible. And probably Trent. I mean, I know I had the reputation from a training standpoint. It was similar as well. So I'm not the poster child for, you know, this crazy amounts of hard work and all. You know, like I think the biggest week I ever did training on my own was probably like 22 hours or something. It was not insane by any stretch. Dang. But
this is my guy.
You're an intelligent man, Pinner. I have to say I respect that. You know, now after all these years of smashing myself, it's like, I also respect that approach of like finding the way to still do the thing that you love and be successful at it, but without absolutely crushing yourself. But I understand towards the latter part of your career, you started working with a coach that I did as well. And this guy was renowned for just putting guys through the ringer as far as I think you had to change your training style a little bit. Maybe tell us a bit about that.
Or was this Inigo?
Yeah.
Was this Inigo?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Inigo.
How was that relationship?
I think the first time he tested me, I flew down, and just for those of people that don't know, like Inigo Semilan now coaches Pogačar, and like the guys won Tour de France with his athletes. Not to mention, I mean, he had a huge history, but he's still very prominent in this. So I flew down to he was working with the team I was with as United Healthcare at the time, and he kind of was on the performance director side of things. So he was testing everybody, and I signed on to him to be my coach, which I was really excited about. So I flew down to Denver, and he got me in his lab, and you know, he got me on the bike, and I'm sure you guys have had it, the VO2 test. He got the mask on and everything, right? And start pedaling. I just didn't feel good. Sometimes, for those of people who haven't done a VO2 test, like, they stick this apparatus on your mouth and everything, and it's dry air. And, you know, like, I'm not good at the dentist, you know? Like, I'm one of those guys that doesn't like that kind of thing happening.
Oh, it's the worst environment for, like, getting the most out of yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're worried this guy's going to find you out.
Well, and you go in there and you've got like, he's got like jerseys from all the, you know, like all these world tour guys and, you know, like big, big riders on the wall, and you kind of go in intimidating anyways. So we start testing, and I knew right away, I'm like, I'm not on a good day, at all. And so I tested really poorly that day, and he kind of calls you into the office afterwards. And I had to give you your results. And I think he's looking at me going like, I can't believe you race on a pro-continental team. Like, basically, like,
he's trying to check and see if they sent in a mechanic as a joke, right? Like, just to see if he really knows his job.
and he grabs these like three or four big books.
Oh, boy.
Grabs three or four big books and he hands them to me, right? And he's like, that's how much extra you're carrying around, because he's weighed these down, right? And then he's like, and I'm having a snack in there, right? Because it gets to the ride. He's like, how often do you snack? And I'm
like, oh, God. So you went in trying to impress the sports scientist by having that constant snacking. That's usually the number one technique.
Needless to say, I was starting from a low bar with Inigo. But to be honest, like it was really eye opening, the training, and a lot of it was zone two. He taught me some things about, and I don't know if guys are still doing it, but you know, like eating three square meals a day, not snacking in between, you know, like putting out high output on the bike in zone two. And so like my zone two, for example, I think when I started, was, you know, I'm about, you know, 78 kilos, 75 kilos, somewhere around there when I was racing. And, you know, my output was like probably like at zone two was, you know, in the mid 200s. And I brought it up to, you know, the low 300s. And
nice.
I was never fitter. You know, I was sending the files back to him, and he was really, you know, by the end of it, he was really impressed. So
he must have loved seeing that improvement. And just so people know, like, that was his approach to training, is like, you had days where he'd just be like, go out and ride your upper end of zone two for 5-6 hours. And I remember, like, Peter, you probably have some good stories from that, but it was like, on days where you weren't quite feeling the motivation, that was like sheer hell sometimes.
It was hard. But when you were on a good day,
oh, nothing better.
Oh, you'd be going so fast. Like, you're going along, and like your zone two would have been faster than my zone two, but you still, like, my zone two, you're cruising along and you're like in the upper 30s, you know?
It was such a satisfying ride when you could pull it off, right? Like, it was just incredible feeling coming home and you're like 36K an hour average. You're just like, whoa, or something like that, you know?
Yeah, you're just flying along.
Yeah.
And I loved it too, because he never talked about really nutrition particularly, because I mean, we didn't get that far along, I don't think, to you really started kind of giving tips. All he would tell me is like, oh, you have to eat a lot. You have to eat a lot of carbs on the bike. You have to, right? Like, once you just get going.
Yeah.
So I gave that was license for me to have like so many Snickers bars. Like, and I would pack I would eat like four or five Snickers bars on a ride, and I was still losing weight. I was still getting lean and getting fast. It was awesome. Eat so many Snickers. I'm sure Pojikar is not on that program. But,
I remember too, you were plowing through the Rice Krispie squares.
Oh yeah. I would buy these boxes of Rice Krispie squares and I would just pound them, It was awesome. Yeah. Those were fun days. Yeah. So it was interesting, you know, like I, from a coaching standpoint, and I'm sure you guys have seen it too, right? Like, it's really, there's no one size fits all, right? Like, different coaches give you different things to work on. And, you know, with Inigo, it was all about making the engine bigger, which was what I needed when I was, you know, I finished that year and I was racing in Europe. And, you know, you think coming from North America as a sprinter, you're like, oh, I just have to, you know, work on my high end or top end for sprinting. Well, it's like, when you look at results sheets from Europe and you see like even a 100-man bunch sprint with 70 guys that don't make the front, like you're like, oh, that's just a bunch sprint. I can get there.
Yeah.
But when you've got like 70 World Tour or Pro Continental guys that aren't making the finish, that's bloody hard.
Yeah, that's a big day. That's a big day. It looks like you said, oh, just, you don't even realize the time gaps, but like from like 101 to 102 could be 17 minutes. That means there's like crazy crosswinds or a massive selection on some climb that, you know, 70 of the best guys going couldn't make it. That's saying a lot, you know, and that engine is everything, Randy, as you know, when you made that transition as well. Like, yeah, it's great to be a sprinter and great to be sneaky and be able to sit on the wheels and all that stuff, but none of it matters if you can't make it over that bloody climb halfway through the race.
Yeah, so I mean, I remember going over to Europe, and then like I went over really late in my career. Like I never went over. Basically, I finished my career on a Pro Conti team with United Healthcare, and I went over for the first time. Like it's not typical at all. I did a little bit of cyclocross and things like that when I was younger in Europe, but that was my first real exposure. And
how old were you then, Pinner? What year was that?
It was my last year. Like I was in my early 30s, I think like 32 or something. Right. And it like my progression, and that's always where I wanted to be. Like that was my dream, is to race at that level in Europe and just give it. It took me a long time to get there, but, that's where I always wanted to be and doing those races. And I did, you know, some stuff like 3 days of Dapana and,
beauty.
I know you guys talked about that in an early race. That's insane. But
puts you know, I do on your chest or what?
Yeah. Yeah. the one race, and I was racing a bunch, a little bit with the Green Edge guys. I think they were called Green Edge back in 2001, but, with that crew anyways. And we did, I spent a little time with them, 'cause I raced, I guess it's July, when really nothing happens in Europe. I raced a race that I don't think happens anymore. It's called the Giro di Padania, which was a one and done. I think it was just Northern Italy, but the on reflection, that was a cool race for a weird reason, was, Chris Froome. That was the year Chris Froome won the Vuelta, and I raced the Giro di Padania in July, and he was racing for Sky then. And it was, I think I beat him on a few hard days that and he turned things around.
He certainly did.
He won the Vuelta.
And then he just went on years of stomping every Grand Tour and basically entered in.
Yeah, I think that was the TSN turning point, the old Giro di Padania that year. But that was – anyways, I raced a little bit in Belgium, like I say, a little bit in the Netherlands, quite a bit in Italy actually, because I can't recall his name. Swain, you would know his name. The director there, who went on, the Italian director, who was racing for UHC at the time, he got us into a bunch of races.
Frattini or something?
I can't believe it. Anyway. He worked with Green Edge. You would know him, Swain. Older guy. Really like a kind of a legend. Anyway, so the name will come to me.
Oh, yeah.
Those Italian races, boy, they are... I mean, I think every country has its different flavor of difficulty, but like the sort of mid-level, not the World Tour. I never did any World Tour level races in Italy, but the mid-level where you have, you know, continental Italian teams, which are registered in like Moldova and weird places like that, man, the desperation of those guys to make it up to the next level, you can just like the risks and everything that guys are taking, it's crazy. Well,
and it's not only the fact that it's like Italians trying to make it in a country that cycling is everything, right? If they can make it to the Giro d'Italia or whatever, that's such a big thing, right? But then to add to that, on those teams, like you're saying, they're registered all over the shop, and they're bringing in strong Ukrainian guys, strong Eastern Bloc guys, right? That are just, they're like, their mentality is like, I have to make this, right? They have such a different cards to play in life compared to North Americans or Western Europeans, right? They are really going to make or break it, right? So that's one thing I wanted to ask you about, Pinner, because you're a great man of words, is like one of the things I'm always trying to pass along, or like when we have some of these discussions with younger riders, is like, what was that transition like? Because you came at a later point in your life where you're able to kind of see things differently than you would have been per se at like 20 or 21, right? So maybe just give us a little, I don't know, just that feeling, that sensation of what it was like to make that transition, because you were in a pretty comfortable team, right? You were confident with your ability, all of those things. And what did you see? What were the big takeaways from trying to make it that year?
Well, the big thing, I mean, for me, you know, I think it's one thing as a sprinter, right? You have to turn your brain off, right? Like you just cannot be, you can't have fear. You just have to really kind of forget that part of what you're doing in order to take the risks. And as I was making that transition from sort of a North American, very, I would say, like on UHC and on Symmetrics, like we had a prominence that were, you know, especially with UHC, that we had a lot of respect in the Peloton. So I didn't have to take that many risks. But when you go over to Europe, you're starting from the very bottom, right? So you're not getting any respect at all. Being a North American Pro Conti team, really nobody cares. And so going over there, like it was almost like starting all over again. It felt like as an amateur racing against the big teams in North America, like the Saturns and the Mercuries, because you're just like, you're thrown in at the bottom. So it's like, oh yeah, like I have to, if I want to do well, I have to really like put up with the headbutting. I have to headbutt. I have to like push and barge and do all those things. And to be honest, like I was, you know, kind of like I was in the twilight of my career. I wasn't really keen on doing that stuff anymore. Yeah. To be honest.
Yeah.
So, and you know, like it, and I was also how I was slotted in as a good way for, you know, in North America, I was kind of really settling in to being a real good support guy in a lead out position. But when you go to Europe, it's like, we had guys like he's a great guy and everything, like Jake Keogh and Hilton Clark, I was helping those guys. But when you took those guys over to Europe, like they just didn't have the engine to make the finish. So it's like, I was kind of sprinting on my own a little bit, and I didn't maybe have the engine to really help a guy like Boy Van Poppel, for example, who was riding with us at the time. So it was just weird. It was definitely different. But the mentality for me, I was just excited. I was like I felt like a young 20-year-old going to Europe. It's like I was at the 3 days of Dipana. That was like my first race in Europe. And I was like, this is awesome, wow. Right? Like, and I was, you know, and I loved it. Like, and, you know, if I had a regret, I was like, I wish I could have started my career doing those races, because that suits my characteristics, you know, like being a bigger guy who's not afraid to like use their size and like be aggressive and crosswinds and the climbs aren't too long and all the rest of it. But I got there eventually, but, you know, it just took a little bit longer than others. But yeah, the mentality was definitely one where I was kind of green-eyed and, you know, like felt like a kid going over there, but then learning, you know, I didn't really have the risk-taking mentality that I did when I was 20. I had a kid, like,
yeah.
I at that time had a toddler. I didn't want to, yeah, it just, things change, you know.
Totally becomes far more difficult.
You're too smart as well.
Those big risks.
Yeah, maybe.
And what you're saying, like, I can relate to 100%. Like, because I came over when I was 32. And even though, like, I felt like I was at the peak of, you know, what I was doing in North America, just like you, I felt like I was starting all over again, having to relearn all these things. So, yeah, that's a pretty wild experience. One of the things.
And it's funny, too, because. Sorry, Swain. It's funny because you race against a lot of those guys in North America, and it kind of gives you a false sense of like, oh yeah, I can just step over there.
Right? That's right. Yeah.
Because you like, I mean, I remember like Tour Georgia, like I was throwing down with Greipel and Tyler Farrar, like, and beating them. And it's like, oh, well, like I can beat you at the Tour of Georgia. Why can't I beat you? Like I should be able to just step over there, but it's a different world.
Right. Cause like as sprinters, you guys are all fast, right? Like in a straight line, you're probably just up there. Like if you could just sprint, right? It's about that battle, how you get there. And then these guys have crazy team support, big lead outs, and they know how the game is, right? So it's just a different world you step into.
Yeah. Yeah.
Randy?
For sure.
It's a bit of the like the media too, right? Like it's like, Swain, you like riding in cold weather. That means you're going to win Roubaix, you know.
Yeah.
Trying to
not to mention the 60 bunch sprints into each friggin' sector, you know, not a fan of. But yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah, Pinner, I wanted to delve into. So, like, you had some great years on UHC, but prior to that, like after Symmetrics, folded in 2008. I'm curious about getting back into those stores, because I feel like that was an interesting time for you, right? You still had the passion to keep trucking, and you were still at a, like, a, you know, you were at a very high level, you know, what we were pulling off in with Symmetrix. So maybe tell us a bit about that transition from Symmetrix over into what I think was Floyd's team, no?
Yeah. Ouch. Yeah. So like 2007, 2008, I think you guys have talked about it. Symmetrix, we had like an awesome run, right? Like it was a really good run. I was riding, getting the best results I'd ever had. Like I was doing well, like at the Tour of Georgia, Tour of Missouri, like on the podium. I don't know. Like I was kind of optimistic that I might have been able to get a shot at a bigger team, but you know, I remember sending and trying to chat with teams like Navigators, for example, and because they had a European program that didn't really go anywhere, and sending something over to Slipstream with Waters, and you know, in hindsight, that was probably never gonna work. I was probably too old and just not good enough, and didn't have the European experience. But I was optimistic that things were gonna happen, and you know, when Symmetrix folded, it was kind of fortunate that at that time HealthNet, which was a big team that had been around for a long time, it the HealthNet sponsor was pulling out, but it was going to continue on with one of the benefactors, Dr. Brent Kay, was going to kind of bankroll a team, and he was Floyd Landis's physician, I think, at the time. So anyways, I remember at Tour Missouri, Cam Evans and I, so Cam from Symmetrix, we both signed on. And it was really interesting because I had Mike Tomeo, who was the director, he signed us on. And, you know, basically just as we're going to put pen to paper, like, because I knew it was HealthNet, you know, the reincarnation of HealthNet, but I didn't know any details that it was Landis at all. And as you guys know, like I'm pretty much quite a vocal, staunch anti-doping advocate, like very. And anyway, so basically just as we're ready to put pen to paper, he's handed me the contract. He's like, just so you know, this is Floyd Landis's team. This is Floyd Landis's
team. Wow. You know, you really got to.
So I was like, oh, you know, and he basically said, like, this team has been bankrolled by Floyd. And you got to remember, like, 2008 was right around the financial crisis, right? Like things weren't good. Right. Yeah. Like, and right. You know, I still wanted to race my bike. You know, I knew the HealthNet guys reasonably well, and I didn't. So, you know, anyhow, I thought I don't really have a choice, and, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to stick to my values and whatever. So I signed on that. So signed on with the team, and it turns out that team was a riot, man. It was crazy. It was Floyd's time back. And the stories that I could tell about that team, you know, would probably take a good hour. But Floyd is a character. I think I think everybody knows Floyd's a character. I remember just the first time we went down in November, kind of to do a new guy training camp to Temecula, down where Floyd lives. And my first meeting with Floyd was it was pissing rain. It was not a nice day out, and we were going to do this big ride. And so we're all in front of the motel. Floyd lives there, so he's not staying in the hotel with us. So anyhow, we go and have breakfast at the hotel as a group. Floyd doesn't turn up. We're just sitting there. And then we get our bikes ready. We go out and we're just kind of waiting around in the parking lot. And so then Floyd turns up. He doesn't have a bike. He's got he's like, where are my shoes? Where's my bike? Like, he doesn't have anything really ready at all, right? And so then, you know, people are scrambling, grabbing a bike and whatever, and then grabbing his shoes and finding that, because he had his brother-in-law at the time was kind of like he had this little entourage. Anyways, his brother-in-law would kind of follow him around and basically have everything ready for him. And so he had that. He had his shoes, and then but he needed a bike, and then he brings the bike over, and they're like, the mechanic's like, okay, Floyd, this is your bike, and but we haven't sized it or whatever. And he looks at the bike, and he looks at the seat, and he's like, that's about right. Like, I'm like, this guy won the Tour de France, and he doesn't give a shit about how high a seat is. Like does not care. He's like, that's about right. And then he's like, I think his name was Max. I think his brother-in-law's name was Max. He's like, Max, I haven't had any breakfast. Go get me some milk. Literally, he just sat down with a carton of milk on the curb, drank the milk, And then off we went. And I'm not exaggerating. That might have been the hardest bike ride I've ever done. Like, and we were just sparring partners for Floyd. We'd ride right. 2x2, and Floyd would stay on the front, and you would just switch off. Everybody would just come up and do a turn next to Floyd. And I'm like, fair enough. That's me, and this guy won the Tour de France. But like, there's like, you know, Cam Evans, like, who you guys know, and probably nobody, not a lot of people who listen to the podcast will know him.
But another machine, though, like, yeah,
a machine, like
he would love to go on a ride like that, right? Yeah, that's right up his alley.
Yeah, and he would tap out, and then like Rory Sutherland. Rory would tap out. Like, nobody could stay with him. Anyway, so we took
I forgot that Rory and was on that team as well. Yeah.
Yes.
Geez, that's saying a lot because he's also a friggin' engine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, saying that I tapped out next to Floyd Landis, that's no big deal. But some of these guys, these other guys, it was pretty full on. So anyways, the story that it makes me think about it sometimes is like, and I'm sure you guys definitely have had this impression riding with guys on world tour teams. It's like, there are some people that are just made to ride a bicycle, that are just freaks, and that are just like, and Floyd is one of them, you know, obviously he's got checkered past and whatever, but this guy, it's just like, there's professional and there's just the freaks. And this guy was a total freak.
Yeah. Like, I incredible. Think you're spot on, Pinner. Like, I think, you know, that's one of those things people look back at his big performance at that Tour de France and just say, oh, that's so insane. But everyone I know who have like worked with that guy or ridden with that guy over the years, it's within his realm of ability. I think what he did in that Tour de France, doping or not, whatever, you know, that was just par for the course back in those days, I think. But I mean, exactly what you said, he's one of those anomalies that come along every so often.
Yeah. And it's crazy in our world, right? Like, to get, I mean, just to get on a continental team is not easy. To get on a pro continental team is not easy. Like, you have to be, it's just like going up the chain of like genetic anomalies, mentally a little bit different, you know, like, and then you get to that level of guys that are, and you're just like, I was pretty good, like, and I know guys that are pretty good at the pro continental level, and these guys are at a whole other level. And it's just like, for young guys, you know, I know you talk a lot about kind of young developing riders. It's like, it's really incredible when you have an appreciation of like, when you're watching these guys on TV and you're like, and you're seeing guys getting shelled in the big races, like those guys that are getting shelled and dropped, whose names you've never heard of, they're really, really, really good.
Yeah. Like, put them in a North American race or a local race, and they're just absolutely crushing.
Yeah. But, you know, but you're looking at them going, why is that guy even there? He's getting dropped. But,
Yeah.
But Floyd, that year was a lot of fun. I don't think I've ever seen a bike team drink as much. Like, the training camps it was like, there was as much drinking and partying as there was biking. And there was a lot of biking. Like, a lot of biking, but Floyd was just incredible. And I actually, you know, it's interesting. Like, I got to know Floyd quite a bit and for that year. And, you know, he's portrayed, I think, in the media as not being a bright guy or was anyways at the time. Maybe that's changed, but, the guy's super smart, like really, really smart. And, he was really interesting to sit down and talk to. And of course his background, right? He comes from, an Amish background, right? And he was, you know, grew up with the Bible and all the rest of it. And you could tell him like a line and verse in the Bible, and more than often he could recite it back to you. And I remember in the Tour of Mexico, and I remember one time we sat down around the table and at the dinner kind of in the evening, and he was like, I don't know how we got onto talking about God, but we were talking about God, and there were some quite Christian religious guys on the team. And he was asking them, why do you believe in God? And he could go toe to toe with why what you're saying wasn't right. Like, why do you believe in God? No, not good enough.
Right.
Not good enough. And like like an incredibly coherent argument as to because Floyd wasn't religious.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it was really fascinating. Super bright guy. Like, you know, just the other another story that I'll and I think people know about it, but the one story that he used to tell about. First of all, he'd say. you'd say, oh, do you think you could? I heard him one time being asked if he could win the Tour, if he could have won the Tour de France again. It's like, of course I could have. It's way easier to do something a second time than it is the first time.
Yeah.
And it's like, that struck me as like, that's, yeah, yeah, that makes total sense. And then the other time, just how bright he was with regard to like just preparation. Like I remember that there was a stage quite famous, I think, at Tour of Nice or Paris-Nice when he won in the rain. It was a really crappy weather day. And he famously was riding without like shorts or arm warmers. Like he was just in a jersey and shorts for a mountaintop finish. And he's like, I remember he was talking about it and maybe it was one of the rainy days we were racing. He's like, have you ever at when you're you know, finishing a wet, cold ride, have you ever lifted your clothes and felt how heavy wet clothes feel?
Oh yeah.
He's like, that's like 10 pounds.
Yeah.
He's like, I didn't win that race because he goes, I was as good as all those other guys, but I was riding, I was 10 pounds lighter.
Yeah.
And he's like, I know I'm not going to, anyways, it was fun riding with him because it was interesting to see you know, the media portrays somebody in a certain way. And it was really cool to get to know somebody that was far more dynamic and different than that. So it was
That's always the case, right? We have these assumptions of who these guys are, but then you actually meet them in person, right? Like I've had preconceived notions about teammates or like people that I didn't know, and then I became teammates with them or whatever, and they turn out to be the most awesome people, you know. And I think that's just something that taught me a lesson, is just don't make those judgments based on what you hear or what have you, you know. But going back to that year, Pinner, I'm curious how that was for you, and then what that transition was like coming from Symmetrics, which, you know, we reminisce all the time about how that was like, you know, I think for a lot of us that were on that team and part of that development over the years was kind of our best experience on a team. So it sounds like that team was like kind of polar opposite in many ways, but I'm curious to know how that year was and then how that transition went for you.
Yeah. I mean, the difference, like one big difference, like I said, how much partying happened, right? Like it was a party team. It was a fun team. Like in Symmetrics, man, I can't even remember any time we went out for drinks or got drunk. But I can there was a lot of that on Ouch for sure. Like it was different because it was definitely, I felt like on Symmetrics, we had like an esprit de corps. We had a common purpose. We were all Canadian. We were really, you know, a lot of us had kind of grown up racing together, and it was on Ouch, it was definitely more of a business, right? Like this is a bigger American team, and you know, these guys are, it was a diverse group, and it was still a good, I would say it was a pretty good culture. It wasn't the same as Symmetrics. Like where I think Symmetrics benefited, and I don't know if this happens at all, but like on other teams, but then certainly didn't happen that much on Ouch and then United Healthcare. But like really, there wasn't a lot. The riders didn't provide a lot of input of who was on the team. I mean, I don't know how I got on the team necessarily when it was Ouch, but like in subsequent years, like there wasn't a lot of input that the riders were able to kind of give management in order to say, okay, yeah, we want to bring this guy on or that guy on. It was sort of more like, this is who we're bringing on. And I think, you know, we had some good culture for sure. Like on UHC, like we, you know, might not have been the fairest thing in the world for all these American pro teams, but we had like the blue train crit squad, and we would go to these criteriums and just mop the floor. And that was a really tight unit. That was a lot of fun. Like the Clark brothers and Brad White, Adrian Hedgeberry, you know, like Carl Menzies, like I had a lot of fun with those guys. And that was as close as I think we ever got to kind of that Symmetrics culture, was kind of this subgroup that we called the crit squad on UHC. And, you know, we weren't the GC guys.
That was a great time in American cycling where there were a lot of these money crits where you could go with, you know, a nice tight knit group and go and actually make some cash as a cyclist like that. I don't think it's like that anymore, eh?
No, it's not like that at all. And it was, I would say, I mean, I think there were bigger money crits maybe a little bit earlier, but there, all that there was a lot of continental teams at the time, and a lot of the, like you had Fly V Australia, that like good teams, like Team Type One, like a whole bunch of pro or continental teams, and maybe like Navigators or something that would come to these races. And we just had it dialed. We just had the crit, the blue train or whatever you want to call it. It was just dialed for winning criteriums. And it was like, and I was not like, it was just, it was ridiculous how much speed we had on that team, because it was like myself and Carl Menzies, typically we were the last kilometer guys or even further out, right? Like we're like, and like either one of us could win. It put us on another team. We probably could have won some of those crits. But that's how we got, like, we were sweeping the podiums, is because we were just like, it was speed in front of speed in front of speed. And then, Hilton Clark came on board sort of midway through 2010. And that guy, if there's any scientist with regard to crit racing, man, that guy is a crit scientist. Like I remember him once saying, like, we would break down a course, we'd figure out who needs to pull where and all the rest of it. And we would just execute. And, oftentimes like just winning the race wasn't enough by the end of it. Like we had to sweep the podium or have two guys on the podium. But I remember him saying one time, like, Pinner, you know what keeps me awake at night? And I was like, what hell? What keeps me awake at night is I try to think of how I would beat us if I was on another team. And I just spend hours thinking about how I would beat us. Like, fair enough, Hills. That's why we're so good. It's because you're the guy who's making the plans, and now you're thinking of how you would beat it. And that was really interesting. And it's interesting. I mean, as good as Symmetrics was at crits, man, like if we'd had a guy like Hilton giving us like the rundown, it would have taken us to the next level. And it's interesting. And I know like a lot of time you guys like to talk about kind of developing riders and young riders and everything. And I think maybe on an earlier podcast, you're talking about like how there's such an emphasis on power numbers, right? And mm-hmm. and how that, in Strava segments and all the rest of it, and young fellas think that they're doing well if they're comparing themselves, their watts per kilo and whatnot. But like what Hilton, and like brought to the table is like an example, like really breaking down of like, positioning and where you need to be and how you're using your energy and all the rest of it. And I think that's been lost a little bit, and it's probably getting lost a lot now because of the pandemic for a lot of these guys, that there's not a lot of bunch races, right? So
yeah, couldn't agree
but
more.
I always thought that was kind of my philosophy of racing as well, like I like kind of that mentality of using less energy. But for me, like, and I did a little bit of coaching for young youth riders as well, it's like cycling is a sport, right? And it's like a sport where I think of it almost like through the lens of like a ball sport. Like if somebody kicks a soccer ball, and you have to go play it, and that's your position, right? It's sort of like the same mentality in a bike race, is like you have to be in a certain place, you have to react to certain moves and put yourself in a certain position. And I think it's interesting, like I still watch a lot of cycling now, and maybe I'm wrong half the time, but I'm seeing things and I'm like, I wouldn't do it that way. Like just like when you're watching even big teams sometimes setting up a lead out, and it's like they're in the middle of the road. Like, why are you in the middle of the road? That means people can come from both sides.
Yeah.
Why and take you over in the corner. The maybe they have a good reason for it, but I still don't know. Like, I still see that there's room for improvement even at the highest level sometimes. But like I said, I'm not there. I'm just armchair quarterbacking it. But I just don't know if that gets emphasized. I don't think it gets emphasized, certainly, for kids in Canada. So.
You just kind of assume, I think, that everyone knows, but it's not the case. And you see sometimes some of the super teams now, too, some of these young guys, they probably haven't been exposed to those lessons, those quick lessons. And so then it's like, boom, the guys behind this assume they know. So then you're in the situation and it's like, oh yeah, we're going down the middle of the road, and the other guys are yelling at them to go left or right or whatever it is.
That guy on the front's just psyched.
Yeah, but
on
I
the
think
front,
that's so
right?
fundamental. You'd think it would be taught, guys would be getting to the top highest level of sport without it, but or with those skills or that knowledge, but it clearly isn't.
No.
Case. I mean, you even see guys going downhill, that there's the guys that can't descend at all. So.
But that just is switching more to a bit of that like freak power, the numbers. Like there's so much more information for teams and coaches everyone to look at the power numbers from when we were.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just think cycling's interesting too, because you get the gamut of people that are just generally good athletes. And like, I know like the two of you guys, like you're just generally good athletes. Like I've seen you on mountain bikes. I've seen you on skis and maybe not you, Ryan, on skis.
Hey,
getting better, Randy.
But like I've seen that, like there's good athletes and you're a good endurance athlete. But then you see people like I've ridden with people that you're like, I don't think if you threw a baseball at them, they could catch it, you know, like,
well, Pinner,
and maybe that's where some of that comes from.
You know, that's one thing I was thinking about, how that style of your racing and the way that you looked at racing actually helped develop me a lot, you know, because up until that point, I was just kind of put my head down and try and smash it. I never really thought about all those little things. So during that time, I learned a lot more about racing. And those are those subtle things, like you said, that are being lost, because I think prior to that, I was just nearly like, without knowing it, I was just a numbers guy. And I think I always appreciated the way that you looked at things. You know, you came at things from a different angle. And I think that helped our team Symmetrics. Like you said, we probably could have been a lot better and obviously would have been if we could have kept working together for many more years. But yeah, I think you were a big part of my development. I just found that you always had a good approach to how to do the races. It wasn't always just about going out and crushing people, you know, because as you know, when you get to a certain level, that's not really possible anymore, right?
Well, that reminds me, I mean, well, thanks, Swain. That means a lot, actually, to say that I helped you along. But I remember kind of emphasizing that. And we, when one of the bigger races that we won on Symmetrics was the US Open. And I don't know if you remember in the bus, like, or at the hotel, whenever we were doing the race meeting, that's when we kind of had two styles on the team and at that time we kind of, myself, you and Wolberg were kind of more the senior guys. Right. And Wolberg's approach through and through is like, cover the moves. We're going to cover the moves from the get go.
It hasn't changed.
Yeah. And I was like, I remember thinking, I'm like, no. We have all these big teams, like the odds of a breakaway getting away that has everybody in it in front of national TV, because everybody's just like super pumped to try to be in the move. It's not going to happen. Like, it's pretty flat running. We do nothing. We just sit in the wheels. We do nothing. And we wait for the circuit. And, you know, I remember like Wolberg must have just thought that was the worst plan ever, because that just goes against everything. He's, you know, like that's just not his style, right? And you know, but that was always kind of my approach was, you know, when I was thinking and developing plans, it was always like, okay, what is the probability of a race is going to finish in a certain way? Like let's think about what are the odds of it turning out in one way and the team that we have, and how do we play those odds? And that day. And that day was perfect. I mean, that day just ended up really well for us. So yeah, I always think about, it's funny. That's my mentality. It's like, it's always stuck with me, even outside of cycling, is like trying to be efficient and trying to do things is like, I even think when I'm cooking dinner, like I'm always thinking of how do I be more efficient and where am I putting things and whatever. And, you know, probably in some ways to my own detriment and with regard to training, maybe, I don't know, but I think it's an approach that like, it doesn't necessarily get rewarded. And I know like I was a good sport about it. And like, I know you guys would always give me the gears about not riding enough. And I got that on a few other teams and everything, but it's just not the culture, right? The culture of cycling is that you go out and you smash it. And people are like, you know, like people don't react to, don't put likes next to a 1.5 hour ride with intervals.
They react to park laps.
they react to the 7 hour epic, right?
Yeah.
And it's just the culture, right? And for some people that totally works. I don't think it worked for me. At least I never tried that really.
I think going back to those genetic anomalies, we're looking at those guys as the examples of how it works. But like you said, what percentage of the population does that actually work for? A lot of people could thrive under possibly doing what you're doing, you know, and it's just like, there's no right approach. And I think that's something really important for young people to understand right away about themselves. But then again, the stuff that you're talking about, it really hits home for me that this stuff is getting lost, you know, like the intelligent approach to bike racing. You're exactly right. That day it was cold, it was snowing, it was a long run into the circuits. You're exactly right. Everyone, it was on television, NBC was there. Everyone thought they were going to be in the breakaway, but everyone was chasing from behind. So it was this constant mess of riders going off the front and people just detonating. And then by the time we got close to the circuits, as you remember, like it was pretty straightforward. Like anyone who had any energy left just kind of went. And it wasn't even like big attacks, if you remember. You were just going off the front, just riding, you know, solid tempo. So yeah, I know we've kind of jumped all over the shop here, kind of looking at your career. But one of the things Randy and I are currently dealing with, and something we're really interested in how that process was for yourself, was the whole subject of retirement. And I think, you know, when your life is, I mean, I think you were a far more balanced individual. You know, you had an outside life and you have other interests. But no matter what that is, like even with your education background and your ability to jump into, you know, I think anyone would want to hire a guy like you. You know, like one of the standout qualities for me about a guy like yourself is like every team needs a guy like you. You're kind of like the glue that binds everyone together. You're laughing and joking, and you have a confidence about you that like everyone wants to, like, you know, you can talk with anyone and anyone feels comfortable with you. And so even with all of those qualities, I still think that transition out of professional sport is a very tough one. And maybe you could share some of the things that you maybe struggled with, but then some of the things you overcame and what you learned through that process.
Yeah. Thanks again. It's kind words, Swain. I appreciate it. The transition isn't easy. And like I had done a couple degrees. I had a master's and an undergrad in geography. And, but you know, the transition, you're so embedded in the world of cycling, and, you know, and I was probably better than most in terms of looking at my options and thinking what I was going to do afterwards to some extent, but it's still not, the transition is difficult, right? I was fortunate that I kind of gave myself, I was pretty thrifty with my money, and I was lucky that my wife had a good job. So I had a runway, right? Like I had a runway to try to figure out what I was going to do with myself. I didn't have to take the first thing that came to me. And so, you know, that was a good thing to have and benefit. The other thing that I also, I think was helpful upon reflection is like, nobody knows what they're going to be doing in 30 years. Like everybody has a game plan. Everyone thinks they know what's going to happen, but nothing happens perfectly in order. Right. And in cycling, you're on this trajectory you're building to the next level, to the next level, to the next race. And things are a little bit more, I guess, in alignment for you. But when you stop and you're starting again, that's gone out the window, right? Like I think what was good for me is like, I didn't wait to develop a perfect plan, a career plan trajectory for me. Like I endeavored to do things, right? Like I tried things and that helped me figure out what I liked and to do. So like what I would say is a great thing for athletes to do, that you're driven, you know what it takes to be successful at something, but don't be paralyzed by thinking I have to have the perfect plan in place in order to get to where I want to be, which you probably won't end up at anyways. Right. You know,
and it evolves along the way, right? Like it can change so much, right?
But you have to try things.
Yeah.
Like you have to try things. You have to like, you can think and you can make all the plans in the world and sit down, but until you actually get your hands dirty and try it, you don't know if you're going to like it.
Wow, that's so
true.
You
don't know if you're going to be good at it, right? Like,
yeah.
And so like, I watch what you guys are doing, and you guys are trying stuff, which is great. And that's why you'll be successful, is that you come with the mentality of an athlete and you know what it takes to be successful and the work that is required, and B, you're trying things. And you'll figure out that there's stuff that you don't like, or you're not good at, or it's just not the right time or opportunity, but you'll land on something, right? Like you look at guys like Christian Meyer or are, you know, that we were teammates with that are entrepreneurs, Christian, Will Routley, like they tried stuff and they're really successful now. But I'm sure if you talk to them, like right at the time when they were transitioning, it wasn't, not every single move that they did was something that they pursued that was going to be successful. Right. So I think for me, I tried things. I thought maybe I wanted to do a career in health administration. So I got into a master's program, but in the meantime, I'm like, I need to work. So I was like, wow, I never thought about coaching, but I took on a role with Devo, and I gave it, which is a local Vancouver youth cycling program that still exists. And I tried it, and I recognized that kind of similar to how I liked being kind of a leader on a cycling team. I kind of like being a leader with just a group in general. It translated outside of cycling, or, you know, outside of a team. And so that's kind of what I do now, in my current job. Like you learn. Yeah. I know you guys are at the beginning of your journeys, but I think what I would say is you're doing, well, or that what I would say is a good move is you're trying stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thanks, Pinner. It's been great having a chat with you, and thanks for taking the time with us today. And I hope everyone enjoyed it as much as we did. Take care, bud.
Yeah. Cheers. I appreciate it. It was really fun.
Thanks, bud.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for having a listen. Back on the Bus podcast with Andrew Pinfold. We hope you enjoyed that episode. That's, what's that, number 4, Randy?
Yeah, that's 4 now.
Dang. So, well, we've been working on this Fraser Valley loop, finally completed it. And what do you think, Randy? It's starting to come together pretty good, eh?
Yeah, it is. It's pretty beautiful out in the Fraser Valley. I haven't, like, you know, when you get so busy coming and going, traveling, racing, and I haven't had much time to just even explore these, you know, like this 100K radius that we live in. For me, it's, it's pretty beautiful out there, though. Definitely opened my eyes to some new riding.
You know, it's funny, like you just saying that too. Like I've lived out here, and obviously I lived here many years ago, and I thought I knew everything about the Fraser Valley, but I'm telling you, in the last 20 years, a lot has come along. And I was out doing some recon again yesterday, and I couldn't believe how many little trails and connections I was able to link up these gravel routes. And so, yeah, come on out with us. June 5th and 6th is going to be our first rides, and we are going to do two separate days. Saturday is going to be loop number 1 and loop number 2. We'll probably come up with some better names, hopefully. And but right now, that's about as technical as it gets. The routes are awesome. There's a little bit of everything, and plenty to see out there. So yeah, stay in our zone, and let's get out biking.